Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'm very happy indeed to be back at BIA. Once again, I feel this is a very valuable institution, a very important center here in Bangkok, in Kongtep Mahanakhon. I'm very glad to have another opportunity to spend an evening with you all. I'll speak in English because I'm 1,000 times better in English than I am in Thai. But if there are words that I use or terms that are unclear, then there'll be a time for questions and discussion after. So if anything needs to be clarified, then I warmly invite everyone to ask for things to be made more clear, more understandable. So the theme for this evening, how can I help? Combining compassionate action with a peaceful heart. So this is a question in the lives of many people, both here in Asia and also in the West. The compassionate initiative, the compassionate impulse in our heart, the wish to be of benefit to others, the wish to, say, assist and give care and concern, to look after those particularly who are experiencing difficulties, this is a strong impulse, and also one that is encouraged within Buddhist teachings, also other spiritual traditions. There's the encouragement to be compassionate, to be caring, to be concerned for the well-being of other people, other creatures, and for our whole world. But the problem that many people experience is that then they have a lot of suffering, a lot of worry, a lot of concern, anxiety, on account of caring for other beings. As it was said in my biography, I spent a lot of time in California. The establishment of Ayagiri Monastery in Northern California was a long process, and so I was teaching there from about 1990 in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then after the monastery was established up until 2010. Just as here in Thailand, and maybe even more acutely on West Coast America, people have a lot of projects caring for other beings, looking after poor people, looking after animals, looking after the creatures in the sea, the redwood trees, looking after the environment. You have organizations like Earth First or Save the Whales, Greenpeace, all very, very active. Particularly University of California in Berkeley is a big center for all kinds of compassionate activity. And many people like Joanna Macy, a very influential writer and Buddhist thinker and teacher, centered in that area, very active and encouraging kindness and care and concern for the whole living world. But one of the experiences that is very common there in the United States, also in Britain, and talking with people here in Thailand, when I mentioned this topic for today, people saying, yes, I know what you mean. That's an important subject. I'll come along this evening. I want to hear. that there's what they call on the West Coast compassion fatigue. I don't have a whiteboard to write that down, but compassion fatigue, that means being worn out by caring for all other beings. You've got the redwood trees, you've got the otters, you've got the sea lions, you've got the whales, you've got the poor people, you've got the homeless people, you've got the yeah, everybody, along with the regular sick people in the hospital, the old people, the dying people, the newborn people. Yeah. It's exhausting to be to have an opinion and to be concerned about so many beings. So that expression is very common here in Thailand. We have people like Khun Sulak Sivaraksa and the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, that same organization, very concerned to be helpful to other beings, and that's very active on the west coast of the U.S., USA. And many people, say part of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship or the similar organizations, that they are very keen to be involved and get, into positions of responsibility where they can have a good effect and bring about things that are a benefit to others. But it becomes too much. You know, that you have your meeting about the whales in the morning and the redwoods at lunchtime, the homeless people in the afternoon, and the dying people in the evening. You know. And, you know, I'm kind of joking, but not joking, you know, that this is a serious issues. And so then by the time you get to 10 o'clock at night, then you've been at four or five meetings during the day, and your family is saying, Mom, you know, remember your children, you know. we live with you, Mom, you know. You're so busy saving the world. What about us, you know? And so this experience of compassion fatigue, I'm not sure what will be a good way of translating that into Thai language, but I'm sure that someone, there's enough creative minds here to come up with a good rendering of that. Being tired, worn out, nui mui, with karuna, too much karuna. Now, the issue I feel is important to talk about, because when we consider the Buddha's encouragement for us to be compassionate for all beings, he couldn't be encouraging that kind of exhaustion or making ourselves stressed or causing ourselves harm on account of the well-being of others. But it's easy to misunderstand, and so I thought it would be a good subject for this evening and to look at, to explore. Now, the English word compassion, it comes from the Latin language, the old Roman language, from two parts, com and passio. So com means with or together, and passio means to suffer. So the English word actually encourages you to suffer along with the suffering of others. So compassion means to share the suffering with of another. So it's the very word is saying, yes, you should be, it's good to suffer the same as others do. You're sharing in their suffering. And so, but that's the word that is usually employed to translate karuna. But probably a better English word is empathy. Empathy, so that, which means more that you are joining together with the feeling of another. You are receiving the feeling of another, but there's not that same kind of say identification, the bonding with that, the suffering of another, so that you're able to feel it, but not be identified with it. But empathy is not such common word in English, but I feel it's a better translation for karuna. Also, the Pali word anukampa is another word that is used in the sutta. Like when you make the request for Dhamma talk, anukampimang pajang, that is the out of compassion for the world. So karuna is a great brightness. It's a what is called in Pali a Brahma Vihara, or a divine abiding, like a heavenly state of being. So that this is a state of brightness, spaciousness, clarity. It's not kind of me tied up in a painful knot on account of your suffering. But like metta, mudita, upeka, these are Brahmavihan, the Brahmaviharas, which means they are sublime, they're divine, they're radiant, they're spacious, they're a really pure emotion. So karuna, in its essence, in Buddhist psychology, is not a state of suffering. It's not, and that in terms of Buddhist psychology, if you are suffering on account of the suffering of another being, then that's kind of mitya karuna, that's kind of wrong or biased compassion. It's a distorted compassion. It's a sort of misunderstanding or a misholding of the quality of karuna or anukampa. So how do we go about establishing that quality of karuna, and how come we get it wrong? You know, what is the cause of that kind of distortion? And how can we, say, learn how to use karuna without that kind of creation of suffering and worry and stress within ourselves? Well, the short version is essentially to learn how to practice compassion without the sense of self, without the me and mine. You know, this is a Ajahn Buddhadasa Center. You know, me and mine is this kind of gets a lot of attention, like problem. This is the cause of a lot of difficulties. Me and mine is the big troublemaker. Yeah. It's and so it's exactly the case here with the issue of practicing compassion and trying to help others. The more there is me and you, a fixed me here and a fixed you there, then the more that any effort to be helpful, any effort to be kind, is going to cause more dukkha, more suffering. You might be able to perform some helpful actions, but you'll create stress in yourself and also more difficulty in the other. And maybe many of us here have had that experience in the past where you're trying to help someone else, and you keep working really hard, you're doing everything you can to be good, to get it right, to be helpful, but the harder you try, the more there is division between you, there's separation, you're apart from the other. And so what do? We just try harder. Do more. I'm not helping, therefore do more. But it's rather like driving further down the wrong road. You took a wrong turn, 3 miles back, and so, okay, I'm on the wrong road, okay, well, I'll just keep going. I haven't got where I want to go, so I'll just, you know, go further, go faster. So that's what we tend to do. We just, in English, we would say more of the same wrong thing. I'm sure you could put that in Thai very neatly as well. More of the same wrong thing. And then eventually we feel frustrated. Well, I'm trying so hard. I'm trying to work out this relationship with my children or my parents or my boss or look after my child or my mother. And no matter how hard I try, we're still not quite having a quality of fulfilled and helpful compassion. And it brings more tension into the situation. But what is, I would say, is the problem is we're not noticing that it's me trying to help you as a tuaton, the me and mine. Or in Pali we say ahankara, made of I am, or mamankara. And Tanajan Buddhadasa has talked a lot, the many, many teachings of his about this doku, konku, me and mine, the troublemaker. I'm sure Thai language has a good word for the source of trouble, the things that causes the problems. So what is then essential before, say, talking about karuna or compassion and helpful action, it's important to understand how we should, the attitude towards practicing Dhamma, the attitude towards working and acting. So I'd like to talk about that for a little bit. Now, when we listen to Dhamma teachings or we read Dhamma books, we see many instructions. You should let go of the kilesa, of the defilements. You should concentrate the mind, be mindful in the present moment. We should say, develop loving kindness. We should have a lot of wisdom, and all of the instruction seems to be let go of the unwholesome, don't create the unwholesome, create more of the wholesome, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that, do this, don't do that. There's a lot of doing, right? And so we can be, and when you go on a meditation retreat, then the Ajahn is always saying, do this, don't do that, sit still, get up, sit down, walk, time to eat, time to listen. There's a lot of doing involved in the development of Dhamma practice, in trying to be peaceful. There's a lot of doing. And so we can be very faithful in following the instruction. But as long as that doing is based on, I want to get rid of my kilesa, I need to get rid of my angry feelings, I need to stop being lazy, I need to get concentrated, I need to develop jhana, I need to have more wisdom, I need to get rid of my laziness and selfish feelings. All of that, I must, I should, I have. We have to, there needs to be attention paid to that, because what that means is we're practicing the Dhamma based on self-view, on Sakkaya Ditti. That it's a good intention. Yes, it's good to dapkile, to let go of the defilements. Yeah, it's good to have samadhi, to have concentration. It's good to have panya, wisdom. Very good, sattu, sattu, sattu. But what's happening is that your plane is being hijacked by the duodon. The effort to practice Dhamma is being based on self-view. I've got a lot of problems. I'm full of fear. I'm full of lust. I'm full of anger. I've got to get rid of my anger and my lust and my fear, my jealousy, and then I've got to get more samadhi and get more panya. And so that is practicing Dhamma based on self-view. And if you start with self-view, you start with ignorance, avijja, you always end up with dukkha. Easy to remember. You start with avijja, you get dukkha. So instead of practicing based on self-view, I should, I must, I've got to get rid of, then we base our practice on Dhamma itself. So what is called Dhammanu Dhamma Patipata, practicing Dhamma in accordance with Dhamma. There's a way of practicing based on right view rather than self-view. And what this means is that we begin, or the very effort that we make in any kind of work, any kind of activity, the first thing is to let go of self-view, to not let that habit of I and me and mine take shape. So that needs to be recognized. In the Pali, we call this bhavatanha vibhavatanha, the desire to be, to become, the desire to get rid of. So these are the troublemaker. This is the source of the difficulty. So if that can be recognized and let go of, then we're able to practice based on right view, and this means to practice based on mindfulness, sati, and wisdom, sati and panya. So then, it can sound very similar. So when we practice, say, right effort, practice based on right view, what it means is that yes, the unwholesome, the akuson, the akusala, needs to be restrained, to be held back. If the unwholesome has arisen, it needs to be let go of. But it doesn't have. But when I say that, we don't need to create a sense of duodon, of I and me and mine around that. Just the effort to restrain the unwholesome. This is the idea, selfishness is unhelpful, therefore it needs to be restrained. Or if selfish feelings have arisen, then the satipanya can recognize, oh, this is a selfish feeling. This is an angry feeling. This is a jealous feeling. We don't have to say, I am jealous, I am angry, I've got a problem with fear. But, oh, fear has arisen. Jealousy has arisen. Anger has arisen. And we don't need to add the duodon, the I and me and mine, to that. Similarly, it's good to cultivate metta. It's good to develop concentration, samadhi. It's good to develop panya. Yes, those are wholesome qualities to bring into being, to give birth to. But we don't have to create those as me. I need more metta. I am practicing panya. I am being wise. I am being awake. We don't have to add the I and me and mine to them. But the wholesome qualities can be developed and then maintained, the anurakana, to support without the duodon. So this might sound a bit technical, but this is a really important element of practice, because if we it's like you set your GPS to the right starting place, you know where you're starting from, so but then you get a good direction from your GPS, your tom-tom. Yeah? If you set it to the wrong starting place, then it gives you the wrong instructions. You know, you're not starting from where you actually are. So when we develop this sense of acting, working, practicing based on right view, on mindfulness and wisdom, then the effort that we make is is in tune with Dhamma. And so if you start off with right view, the result is peacefulness, is clarity, is Nibbana. Okay, so easy to remember. You start off with ignorance, avijja, you end up with dukkha, suffering. You start off with vijja, with right view, you end up with Nibbana. You can put that on your fridge, put on the t-shirt, okay. You start out with ignorance, you end up with dukkha. Start out with wisdom, you end up with Nibbana. So this is, when we want to be helpful, and we want to practice karuna, and yet for that not to be a burden, this is the important thing, to look at that duodon, that feeling of I and me and mine. Because as long as it's me trying to help you, there'll always be dukkha in the mix. But rather, that if we can see, well, this is the experience of dukkha, there's a perceiving of difficulty, of suffering, and then there is not a creating of a sense of me and you, but more there is a response can be brought forth in us based on mindfulness and wisdom. Many years ago, one of the nuns in our community was going back to visit her parents in Scotland, and her family were very negative about her being a nun. They were sort of conservative Presbyterian Christians. and they were so against their daughter being a nun, they wouldn't let her in the house without a hat on. They wouldn't let her shaved head be in the scene in their house. So she used to have to wear a little woolly hat if she was with them. So they were very negative. But she's a very caring and kind person and was very concerned to not have a negative or difficult relationship with her parents or to cause them more suffering. So she was very worried about trying to get it right and what's the best way of being with the family. And so one day she was about to go back and visit them, and at the Santanatama, the tea time, question time with the Lumpo Sumedho, she said, she asked the question, what's the best way that we can help our parents? The response that Lumpo Sumedho gave was, it was absolutely wonderful, because you could tell he hadn't thought about it before. It just came out of the jitwang, out of the empty mind. And he just said, the kindest thing that you can do for your parents is not to create them. Understand? To not create them, which doesn't mean you go and shoot them, you know. It means that you're not carrying around, oh, my mom, my dad, they're like this, I'm like that. I want to get things right so that they will be happy. Because it's not that we don't care, but if I create you, that means when I meet you, I just meet my creation. I don't meet you. I've got my set of ideas, my list of, this person is like this, Ed is like that, Nong is like this. I have my list. So I don't meet you, I meet my list. Right? And in English we use the word projection for this. We just create projections. And maybe we care a lot, we worry a lot, so our list of projections is really big, really thick. So we're not able to attune to another. We're not able to be in harmony with another because we're so busy trying to get it right. I'm trying to get it right for you, that the air is filled with all of that projection, and we can't really meet affect each other beneficially. So that is, important for us to understand how to not create each other, not because we don't care, but because that's the way our caring is most completely fulfilled. Now, there's a number of years ago, and when I was living in California, there was friend and a supporter of the monastery, and was one of the group of lay people that were trained to be like lay Dhamma teachers by Lumpo Pasanno and myself. His name was Kundanya. And he had a massage. It's a traditional massage school, body work, and a physical therapy school in San Francisco and Berkeley. And he had cancer of the bowels and died when he was in his early 50s. And one of his students was living in Taiwan, and so she couldn't come to the funeral. So she wrote a letter that she asked to be read out at his funeral. And there was things that she shared in that letter and of appreciation about Kundanya as her teacher that I feel are extremely valuable and insightful principles. So I'm invited to talk on this area of compassionate action, I like to quote Kundanya. You know, he is a lay person, but I feel that the wisdom that he developed was extremely valuable. So this woman, her name was Rachel. Rachel Starbuck, like the coffee Starbuck. But she had the name before the coffee chain opened up. So, she said, my name is Rachel Starbuck. I was a student of Kundanya for many years, and I'm sorry I cannot be at his funeral, but I want to express my gratitude and share with everyone present how he affected my life deeply. And she said that Kandanya would emphasize three principles when training his students, and said three things to understand when working with others, so doing physical therapy or other kind of massage or working with others. So the principle number one is don't push, just use the weight of your own body. So not kind of pushing, but just to lean. And when you're doing massage or you're physical therapy, don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Again, I'm not sure if you understand the word diagnose, like a doctor says, oh, this is your problem, I know what your disease is, you got this, 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 and this, and it's because of this cause. So doctors, probably a few doctors here, you know, you're paid to have all the answers, right? And so the doctor is supposed to be able to say, this is the cause, this is the problem, this is the cure. But the encouragement was don't diagnose, just be aware, so that you're attuning, you're listening to the situation, you're receiving all of it rather than, I know what the answer is. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, is the third one, but don't turn away. So three principles. Don't push, just use the weight of your own body. Don't diagnose, just be aware. Don't try to help, but don't turn away. So these, I feel, are extremely skillful principles. And then Rachel went on to explain how she'd heard Kandanya speak of these very often. She'd written them down in her notebook during the classes. She said, but they really came alive for her when she was on her first 10-day meditation retreat, and she was extremely miserable, very, very unhappy. So about fourth or fifth day of the retreat, and she's really depressed, everything has gone wrong, she feels awful. She said, I felt dreadful. I went in the breakfast time to the far corner of the dining room. I took my oatmeal, my porridge, sat down in the corner and was just kind of crying into my oatmeal. And then Kandanya, who was on the retreat as well, and of course you're not supposed to speak at all, so Kandanya came and she said he just brought his own oatmeal and he sat down next to her. She said, he didn't look at me. He didn't kind of make any kind of sign. He didn't sort of squeeze my arm or say, you know, you look miserable, how can I help? He said, he didn't look at me. He didn't touch me. He just sat down next to me and he ate his oatmeal. Just that's all. He was just there. No sign, no message. Just he was there next to me. And she said, and I found that so helpful and so comforting that it really stayed with me. So a few years later, her younger sister was about to give birth to her first child. So this is a big event in the family. So Rachel said, I went to birthing classes, so to be a birth assistant, to help be with the midwife and my sister while she's having her child. And said, during the birth, my sister is in labor, and she's screaming and screaming in intense pain. She didn't want anyone near her, didn't want anyone to touch her, just... I haven't given birth to any children in this lifetime, but probably in other lifetimes we've all been each other's mothers, you know. So, yeah, you probably gave birth to me a few times, I've given birth to you a few times. So we've probably all been there in some life or another. So she was then there's little sister and screaming with pain, and then she suddenly remembered what Kandanya did for her. So she just went into the room and she sat down at the end of the bed, didn't kind of make eye contact with her sister, didn't say anything, just went in, sat down by her feet at the end of the bed and just did nothing. After her sister had the baby, then she said, you know, that was so helpful. I was in the middle of that labor thing. And in that, all of that kind of total pain experience, it was so helpful that you just came and you sat there, and you were just present. And thank you for that. And she said, and now when I see my sister with her 2-year-old son, and he's really unhappy, wah, 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 and he's screaming and cranky and upset, and she's just holding him, and she's just there. She's not trying to make him happy, not trying to fix him, but she's present, and she's holding him, and he can just have his tantrum, as they call it. And so she said, in that I see Kundanya's life and the embodiment of his teaching coming down from one generation to another. And you can be sure that that little boy, when he's probably a teenager by now, that those principles are also kind of resonating, moving out from his experience into the lives of others. So this is, I feel, these are really good principles to embody, because they, in a way, in the more human terms, they talk about how to work but without atta, how to engage. You are not saying, I understand, I've got the answer, I'm going to fix this, but you're still there. And it's not like you don't care, it's not like you don't bother, or it's like, your problem, I'm just going to sit here. But yeah, you do care, but you're ready to act if you need to act, but you're also able to leave things alone if you need to leave it alone. So when we are able to let go of that feeling of creating others, trying to fix others, trying to make everything all right for you, then we are able to find that sense of and to trust that sense of, I do care, and at this moment I'm paying attention, and I'm listening, I'm watching to see, is there something to be done? Is there nothing to be done? If there's something to be done, what's a good thing right now? Now, many of us, we create a lot of stress and suffering in trying to help others by this, what we call in the Western psychology, the superego, saying, it's the thing that says, you should. That's the superego. Like, a perfect child, if you were a good daughter, you should. If you were the ideal son, you should. If you were a good father, you should. If you were the good, if you were a good doctor, if you were a good Ajahn, you should. That's the superego, and that often runs our life. We put the superego in charge, and so then what we find is we're never good enough. We're not perfect enough. We're always trying to be this perfect person, like a Prabhuturu, a Buddha image. The Buddha hasn't moved since I was here last year. Still. Perfect samadhi. Never even scratches the ear. Doesn't need to eat. Doesn't get sore knees. Doesn't need to breathe. But we try to be like a Buddha image. We say the perfect me, the perfect father, the perfect mother, the perfect doctor, teacher, the perfect child. We would be never making any mistakes, always perfect, like the Buddha image. Peaceful, calm, wise. But it's not alive. It's an ideal. It's not real. It's an image, rupa. It's a rupa. It's not alive. And so that it's good to have a Buddha rupa. They're useful. That's why we always have them in a high position. It's useful to have an ideal, but the real life is this one. The breathing, eating, imperfect life, that's the one we work with. So in that recognizing of the ideal, we recognize, if I could help, if I could fix this, then I would. But I have limits. I have a capacity. There's a kokei. You have to know what your capacity is, but also to trust that you are doing the best you can. When I was a novice many years ago, I've been a monk, as I said, since 1978. I became a novice at Wat Bananana Chat. And during that time, there was a very interesting meeting, that encounter that I had. Because ever since I was a small child, I had a lot of compassion. I used to feel very strongly for other creatures. Yeah. When I was a child, I was not allowed to watch the Walt Disney movie Bambi, because they wouldn't let me see it, because the mother deer gets killed at the beginning of the story. And I found out later, when I was in my 30s, they told me, I said, hey, you know, I was on this plane, and I on a plane ride, and I saw Bambi, and I said, and I kind of remember, do I remember right that you wouldn't let me watch that when I was small? And my mother said, "Oh yes, we wouldn't let you watch it." I said, "Well, why was that?" "Well, because if you'd seen it, you'd just have been in tears for a week, or the whole family would have to deal with you in having a state of trauma for a couple of weeks." So we just said, "No, you can't watch Bambi." It's true. So I didn't see Bambi till I was about 35. And even watching Heidi, which is not that tragic. But my mother said that she came into the living room of the house, and there was my two sisters, and they're sitting watching the black and white TV, and the Heidi and the children in the Swiss mountains. But I was sitting there with tears running down my face. Because Heidi's trying to help this poor little sick girl. So I had a lot of karuna, but it was a kamicha karuna. And so I would feel very responsible for the suffering of others. And that if I knew someone, or there was another animal or creature that was suffering, I took it as my responsibility to help them, to fix them. And if they weren't fixed, it was my fault. Maybe some of you are thinking, yes, that's right. You know, if you know and they're still suffering, you should try harder. You should do more. It is your fault. So this was a big sort of spiritual question for me through my teens. So a conversation that happened when I was a samanen at Wat Bananana Chat was. This one day, the meal time is early in the morning, about 8:30. So by about 10 o'clock, everything is tidied up and people have gone. Usually, no one is around in the meeting hall, the sala. So I happened to be there, and everyone else had gone. I was just sweeping up or something, and this Thai middle-aged man came to visit, and he was a soldier. And so unusual at that time, he was able to speak some English. Usually in the Northeast, the people who came to the Wat didn't have any English, and I didn't speak any Thai at all. But anyway, he was a soldier, as a colonel, and coming to visit the area, heard about Wat Bananana Chat, just took the opportunity to come and see the place. So we got chatting, and I'm the kind of person always ready to chat with anybody, everybody, you know. I'm a verbal kind of a person, chatty. So we got talking, and somehow we got into conversation about helping other people and being a helpful person. And the way I was speaking was as I was described, though, I always want to help others, but I always feel upset or sad because I can't. I can't help others, or I see like a dog in the village that's got bad skin disease, or is very hungry, or an old person, and they're kind of really bent over, and they can't walk properly, and so it would make me suffer a lot that I couldn't help them. And then this gentleman made this comment. He said, and he kind of looked at me like, "That's strange." And I said, "Well, because you know, I'd like to be able to do more. I'd like to really be able to help, but I can't." And then he said, and he wasn't trying to be so special or clever. He just said, "Well, you know, I see it very differently, because I know that if I could do more, I would do more, but I can't, so I don't make a problem out of it. And it was completely obvious to him. It was so matter of fact. Like, well, I know if I could help, I would. I could fix it, I would. But I can't. If I can't fix something, then why would I suffer about that? Because then you've got two suffering beings instead of one. And again, he wasn't trying to be clever or be superior, but it was just like so obvious to him. I don't know who he was. I never saw him again. But I thought, oh. And it was this feeling of like where you have you're trying to put a shape into a box. I'm looking for the box to put that in, like in my thoughts. And I thought, and I couldn't find a place to put that. I'd never had that thought in my life. It was like my mind had never thought in that way my whole lifetime, ever since I could start thinking. It was just amazing to me. But to him, his expression was so sort of, yeah, naturally, well, isn't that obvious? Why would you suffer over something that you can't do? And so that had a very powerful effect on me. And it was very helpful to see, yeah, you because he trusted that, yeah, I'm not being unkind. It's not that I don't care. I do care. I care a lot. But you know, there's a limit to what I can do. If the limit was bigger, I'd do more. But at the moment, today, the limit is like this. So he said, if I can lift a rock of 30 kilos, I can lift. But I can't lift a rock of 50 kilos. I know 30 kilos is the limit. So I don't suffer because I can't lift 50. I'm happy I can lift 30. And maybe I can do more exercise and learn. But today, that's the limit. That's what I can do. So I don't create suffering of being not able to do things that are outside of my capacity. So that, I feel, is important. And along with letting go of the duodon, the self motivation for practice, to let go of self and be guided instead by satipanya, mindfulness and wisdom, then along with that, there's this sense of trusting, having the sadha that you do care. And even if someone is saying, like, you're not worrying, therefore you don't care. Right? Sometimes it's like that. You know, if you really cared, you'd be upset. Right? And it's important to try to not be intimidated by that. Say, well, you're welcome to your opinion. Thank you for sharing. That's how you see things. But I do care, and no, I'm not upset. But in the States, they also have an expression of, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. Like, so, well, that's your opinion. You are welcome to that opinion. People, if they want to project judgments on you, that's their business. So this morning I was having a conversation with someone and saying, you know, it's important to learn how to be misunderstood. Yeah? That if someone is saying, if you really cared, you'd be upset, you'd be as angry as me, or you'd be upset, you'd really be annoyed. And to listen to that, to receive that and say, yeah, well, thank you for sharing. That's your feeling or that's your opinion. You're completely entitled to that, but I'm confident that I do care. You might see it differently, but I do care, but no, I'm not worried. I'm not angry or upset. I care and I'm doing what I can, but I'm not angry or upset. And so it's maybe a subject for a whole different Dhamma talk, but I feel this is a really important practice, is to be misunderstood and misrepresented. People say, oh, this is what Yom Dim, this is what she thinks, or this is what Mr. Sandeep, he's like this. and let me tell you all about him, or Yom Plern, she's like that, you know, and then give you a long list of their projections. And you say, oh, interesting. Thank you for sharing, as they say in California. that's the projection that you wish to put on me, fine. But we can not have to defend ourselves, not make our happiness dependent on other people seeing ourselves in the way we want to be seen. Because if my happiness depends on you seeing me as I would like you to see me, it's going to be really difficult to be happy. But instead, to have the trust, the confidence that I'm doing what I can. It's not perfect, it's not absolutely right, but I'm doing what I can. If you want to give me some good advice and tell me how to do it better, sadhu, thank you. I'm happy to receive your advice. I'll do what I can with it. So in this way, we're learning to respond to situations rather than react. If you want to be helpful, to have confidence that we're doing what we can, and that if our capacity to do more or to do things differently, it can be improved, that we're ready to learn. We're not sort of proud or, who do you think you are? Or, you know, I know my job. But to be ready to be corrected. Okay, one of the most important books I've read recently by a doctor is by a Sri Lankan doctor called Atul Gawande. I recommend this. This is really good reading because, again, many of you are doctors, and probably you, if you are a consultant, then you really have to be right all the time. And it's your job to be confident. You're the one they consult. You're a consultant. So you've got to get it right. And so you have the tua ton yai yai. It's quite normal for a consultant. You know, in the UK, they would often have the nice big moustache, you know, be very proud. So this book is called Complications. He's written a number of kind of popular science books, but this is the one that I read. It's called Complications, and it's about the mistakes that doctors make and the limits of knowledge and the limits of capacity to help. And I thought, this is wonderful. A doctor, a working doctor, you know, writes a book about all the things that they get wrong or the things that are difficult. And each chapter has a different theme, like when you make a wrong diagnosis, when you find out, I got it wrong, and the patient is really harmed by your wrong diagnosis. Or when a patient can't be cured, when you get the right diagnosis, but you can't fix it. Or what do you do when the consultant has got an alcohol problem, but he's really famous and the head of the department, but he's drunk? What do you do? How do you work with that complication? And I feel if I'm not promoting book sales, but because there's, a really important principle within that, that how marvelous that someone who's supposed to be an authority is ready to learn and ready to recognize the kind of limitations that in terms of helping others, that humility, that sense of, yeah, there are complications. You don't always get it right. We make mistakes. We can't always fix it. Life is complicated. And we are not in control. You know, even though a doctor, you know, I'm not just picking out doctors, but you know, university professors of other kinds, teachers, we're supposed to be the expert, Ajahn. You know, it's my title is Ajahn. You know, that you're supposed to be an explainer, you know, Acharya. That's the job description. You know, so I'm supposed to explain to you. You know, therefore I'm supposed to understand, but then. Every so often we get a situation where we don't understand. We can't explain. You know, it's not within our ability. And I feel it's important to recognize, you know, some things can't be fixed. And the way that we help is to recognize, I don't know what to do here. I have no answer for this. That I don't know what the best way forward is. That's the way that we help. Can be to say, I don't know. Or there's nothing I can do here. There's a... But also, you know, sometimes that's the right thing to do is also to recognize, just leave things alone. There's a famous, well-known Dhamma teacher who was with his stepmother as she was dying. And he had written a number of books. He's quite well-known for giving advice to the dying, and would lead seminars and workshops on death and dying. There's an American Dharma teacher called Ramdas, out of the Hindu tradition. And so his stepmother was dying. And here he is, I'm the expert, I've written books about death and dying, so you know, I know my stuff here. So he's sitting by the bedside of his stepmother, and he's giving her this guided meditation, say, about staying with the breath and breathing in, visualizing the light of pure wisdom, breathing in the light and letting go of all of your worries, anxieties, and giving her this whole kind of extensive guided meditation. And he tells this story himself, so it's not just put-pit, I'm not kind of criticizing him, but he tells the same story. So he's giving his mother this kind of long and involved guided meditation, and after about half an hour, he kind of pauses for breath, and she turns her head to him and says, Ramdas, be quiet. Right, I was being the expert, you know. I've written books about this, you know. I'm Mr. Death and Dying, you know. I know how this should be, and so she had the wisdom to recognize, leave it alone. I just some quietness and an absence of explanation would be good. So sometimes that's the wisdom is that to just leave things alone. And the way we can help is just to be still, and to. But then, out of that stillness, we're also listening. And in the northern Buddhist tradition, in the Five Mahayana, they have the different bodhisattvas that represent different paramita. So, like the bodhisattva of wisdom is Manjushri. Has a flaming sword to cut off avicca, ignorance. And the Samantabhadra is the bodhisattva of strength, of virya, of adhitana. And then the bodhisattva of compassion is Guanyin bodhisattva, or Quanxiyin bodhisattva, Guanyin, Pasatai. And the words, the Sanskrit name is Avalokiteshvara, or Chinese is Guanxi Yin. And that means the one who listens to the sounds of the world. So the embodiment of compassion is represented by listening, the one who listens. And when you see images of Guanyin, sometimes it's just a human female figure. Sometimes they have many, many arms, 1,000 arms with a 1,000 hands and an eye in the palm of each hand. But the name is the one who listens. So I feel this is in terms of helping others and learning to help with a peaceful heart, then Guan Yin is a good image. That there is the at the center of it is the listening heart. Listening. And then you have the hands, the many hands and eyes, 1,000 hands and eyes that can, ready to act in different ways to help. But exactly what is needed in any one moment is mayneh, is uncertain. It depends on the attunement, the quality of listening. And so, and Guan Yin is a bodhisattva of compassion, but she's not suffering on account of the the dukkha, the suffering of other beings, but she's caring, ready to help, but not creating dukkha. And then also in the hands, if you see the traditional images of Guanyin or Avalokiteshvara, some of the hands, they have like a lotus flower or a Dharma book, a sutra. But some hands have like swords and arrows and whips. Because sometimes the right thing to do is to be fierce or be strong. You know, if you're, again, going back to the doctors, you know, doctors, they have a knife. And you're really glad that the doctor has a knife. When you need surgery, and it's good that the doctor has a good, sharp knife. that sometimes that's the appropriate way that compassion is carried out. You know, I have a 4-inch scar on my neck here. Yeah, from an operation I had many years ago, I had a lymph gland that died. So I'm glad that the doctor stuck a knife in my neck. Otherwise, I'd had a really big problem. So sometimes that is how karuna is carried out, with a sharp knife, with a weapon. Sometimes it's carried out with a flower, with a blessing, you know, a sweet dew of comfort. But what is the right thing in any one moment, for any one situation? It depends on that quality of satipanya, of attunement to the time, the place, the situation. So I will leave my offering of Dhamma teachings there, and I hope some things are useful and you can take them with you, and anything that is not useful, please leave behind. Anyone?